Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
Allison, to set up the next interview, let's hear a little bit from Butch Cassidy.
Woodcock.
Yes, sir.
You know who we are. You're the hole-in-the-wall gang, Mr. Cassidy. I understand that. But you got to understand Mr. E.H. Herman himself of the Union Pacific Railroad gave me this job. And I've got to do my best, don't you see?
Your best don't include getting yourself killed.
Dynamite's ready, Butch.
Mr. E.H. Herman himself, he had the confidence of you.
Open the door or that's it.
You think E.H. Herman would get himself killed for you? Woodcock?
I work for Mr. E.H. Herman of the Union Pacific Railroad. And he entrusted me.
The E.H. Herman that the fictional Woodcock was so devoted to was in fact real. Indeed, E.H. Herman was an American financial giant, the head of the Union Pacific Railroad, and the architect of the ill-fated Northern Security Trust, which was the railroad combination broken up by Theodore Roosevelt in the antitrust case that gave Roosevelt the reputation as a trustbuster.
Herman is one of many characters in Zachary Carabel's new book, A History of Private Commercial Bank, Brown Brothers Herman, entitled Inside Money. The Brown Brothers saga begins in the early 19th century when Alex Brown left Ireland to come to Baltimore and establish a linen import business. Brown Brothers played a critical role during the 1800s in facilitating the flow of capital and goods between America and the world through its pioneering role as a trusted source of credit. The firm was and is a small partnership, a choice that in sharp contrast to the larger publicly held firms like Morgan and Goldman Sachs. And after the merger with Harriman in the 1930s, it was run by men who were the quintessential American WASP establishment, moving between government and finance. Men like Senator Prescott Bush, father and grandfather of presidents, Robert Lovett, Secretary of Defense during the Korean War, and Avril Harriman, who served as governor of New York and a senior diplomat under four presidents.
So how does the history of this firm parallel the development of the American economy? And what does that history teach us about the relationships between money and power over time? We're really fortunate this morning to have with us author Zachary Carabel to talk about the new book and the Brown Brothers saga. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money, Mr. Carabel.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So let's start with some background. What motivated you to write this book and how long did the process take?
So first, I'm so glad you played the Butch Cassidy line. I've been wanting to get that in there and I've spent a lot of time over the years at the Sundance. It was fun to be able to get that into the book. And I guess one other regional thing before we get into the more meat of the book, Avril Harriman, the son of E.H., who's obviously central to the firm, Brown Brothers Harriman, also underwrote the creation, not just underwrote, but really was the impresario who creates the Sun Valley ski resort in the 1930s, partly as a way to save the Union Pacific Railroad, which was then dwindling in profitability and importance. So I wanted to write about the way money made America. And there is no institution that can tell that story better than Brown Brothers Harriman, because it is the oldest private bank in the United States, really older even than they themselves claim. They put their founding date at 1818. I think it's more accurate to put it at the time that Alexander Brown, the family patriarch, comes from Belfast, Ireland, fleeing the Troubles to relocate in Baltimore as an Irish linen merchant. And it survives to this day. Now, surviving a long time is not a reason to write a book. I mean, it may make for an interesting internal story, but it doesn't make for necessarily a compelling story. Living long is a virtue, but it doesn't necessarily make for a good book. But they are really at the epicenter of this idea of how does money make America, and particularly the role of money in fueling the rise of the United States economically in the 19th century, and the way in which the men who made the money of the 19th century then make the world of the 20th, insofar as they set up the global, international economic and political system that is the world today. Flawed or not, it is the world today. And again, Brown Brothers was the way of telling that story.
And let's talk a little bit about the original business of the Brown family and the values. One of the things that was really interesting to me about the book was the emphasis on values that were so important to Alex Brown. How significant was, you know, how did it work at the beginning, and how significant was his ability to locate family members in locations around the world?
Right. So, I mean, a key aspect of this book is the importance of the culture of an organization and the culture of the people who run it. And, you know, not to do the spoiler at the end, but part of the lesson of Brown Brothers is this set of values that had to do with the relationship between private gain and public good, the idea that those with great power have a great responsibility to give back and to serve the public. And that in many ways was imprinted by Alexander Brown, this patriarch, in his letters to his four children. So he comes to the United States and then he dispatches his four sons to important economic nodes in the early 19th century, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, and Liverpool, which Liverpool in England was the main port for transatlantic trade. And that wasn't really unusual, meaning trading had usually been facilitated by family firms, the Rothschilds, the Fuggers, the Barings, because family ties were one of the only things that gave you some level of trust that if you sent goods far away, someone would be there to pay for it. And if you paid for goods far away, someone would send it to you. And that was always the problem of international trade from like time immemorial. How do you make sure that those two things happen? And family bonds were one of the ways you did it. But what's really unusual about the Brown family is this kind of rigorous, albeit in many ways cliched set of values, like some version of Poor Richard's Almanac and Warren Buffett homilies, you know, be careful who you do business with, and trust is hard to gain and easy to lose, and don't go after too much and make do with enough, you know, all these things. But what's fascinating is it manages to be the DNA of this firm for more than two centuries.
So you talk about trust and really how they were able to build the firm, but they were really kind of at the forefront of many things. Can you explain what paper instruments issued by Brown were used in international trade and what were their significance?
Sure. So, I mean, think about the Brown family as, and I'll get to your question in an elliptical way. Think about the Brown family as like Zelig, if you remember that movie from the 80s, where chameleon-like there is at every important juncture of American history, there's a Brown Brothers banker in the second row back left looking like a banker, totally uninterested in being the story, but without whom there is no story. So they help fuel all these important moments in history. The creation of the first railroad, the Baltimore and Ohio, the B&O of monopoly fame, the creation of the first American transatlantic steamships to rival Cunard, who ends up building the Titanic. And as you just alluded, creating these letters of credit, which was a paper instrument, somewhat arcane and, you know, not necessarily good to go into in a few minutes of radio. But suffice it to say, without these letters of credit, that question that I raised earlier, if you're going to send a lot of goods across the ocean, how do you know that someone's going to pay for it? And if you're going to pay for a lot of goods that are going to be sent from across the ocean, how do you know someone's going to send it? Those two challenges are what these letters of credit solve for, to give some assurance to the buyer that they will get the goods and some assurance to the seller that they will get paid. And they become, Brown Brothers becomes the main facilitator of the cotton trade, which of course raises all sorts of legitimately problematic moral questions, given that to be embedded in the cotton trade meant to be embedded in the slave system. And Brown Brothers is, you know, absolutely morally complicit in this immoral system, as was much of the North. Even though there was no slavery in the North, you know, the economy of the North depended a lot on the slave system of the South. But such is, you know, the story of American history. And that's part of what I try to tell in this, that it is not black and white. It is many, many shades of gray.
And it is interesting the way, that as you go through the story, the way the Brown Brothers Bank shows up, as you say, with railroads and with international liners. One of the stories you talk about is the unfortunate adventure they had with respect to the ocean trade. Talk a little about that and the lessons that they took from that.
So it's interesting. Because in part of what happens in the 1850s when Brown Brothers become so prominent as the issuer of these letters of credit that are trusted more than any currency, right? There's no U.S. dollar that's issued regularly by the federal government until the Civil War. And the paper that Brown issues, which lubricates this whole financial system, is trusted in a way that very little is. And it does make them quite prominent in a way that leaves them desirous of never being prominent again. One of the challenges of writing this book is, how do you write about an institution and a set of people who are central to the evolution of the American economic system and central to the evolution of American global power in the 20th century by people who had no interest in being in the news? You know, every day that they wake up is a good day that they're not in the papers. And in the 1850s, they fund, as one of their few almost speculative ventures, the moonshot of the day, you know, this transatlantic steam enterprise, which was, you know, partnered by a very roly-poly, impresario P.T. Barnum-like figure named Edward Knight Collins. And it all ends tragically when the flagship of the Collins line sinks in a freak accident, and with it, several members of the Brown family and several members of the Collins family. And this sort of tragedy for the Brown family is the last time they really want to be in the news or want to be involved in anything that reeks of speculation, even though, frankly, building the transatlantic steam lines was hardly as speculative as, you know, Elon Musk was 15 years ago saying, I'm going to build a battery electric car company. So they really eschew the spotlight and they eschew anything resembling speculation for the next 170 years, but they still manage to become rich, powerful, and potent.
I want to just dip into that for just a little second. I mean, you look at now as far as, you know, companies and people who they themselves kind of shoulder the, we're doing business for the good of the public, but they're so central. They are the linchpin, or seen by the public as the linchpin to many of these efforts. What did staying under the radar allow them to do that perhaps kind of the alternative of seeking that attention may not have?
I think, you know, they felt that if they were front and center in the story, it meant that they couldn't be primarily serving their clients. And, you know, today there's a whole debate in the U.S. about fiduciaries and people who manage money, and that their incentive should be only to profit if their clients profit, not just themselves. Brown Brothers sort of, it doesn't invent that ethos, but it lives and breathes it for centuries before anybody else was talking about it. And to some degree, them being the story would have meant that their clients weren't, or that the business they were facilitating was less important than the business they were doing. And as a partnership that stays beneath the radar, they are devoted to the idea of being of service to their clients. And then, you know, in the 20th century, the idea of being of service to their country, they enter public service, these partners. And you mentioned Prescott Bush, but also Averell Harriman and Robert Lovett. And that's a very particular ethos of service. And I want to be clear in the book and in my own thinking, I think human beings are messy and complicated. So I mentioned the slave trade. They were complicit in slavery. They were also founding members of the Republican Party. They wanted to be of service, but that doesn't mean that they were not intensely self-serving. They thought that they were selfless, which did not preclude them being selfish. So, you know, these sort of yin-yang qualities, I think, exist and have continued to exist. But it's important, I think, to realize that there was a form of capitalism that Brown Brothers came to embody that was not the same too-big-to-fail, rapacious capitalism that has come to define finance capitalism and technology and private equity and venture capital over the past 30 years.
We've talked a little bit about the Brown Brothers route of the company. Let's move a little bit over to the Harriman side. Tell us a little bit about the Mr. E.H. Harriman that we played the clip from at the beginning and the evolution of railroads in the 19th century.
So he was like one of the quintessential robber barons, although I don't think he's gotten the same level of attention as, you know, the J.P. Morgans and the Leland Stanfords and the Collis Huntingtons. Maybe because he was somewhat later into it, or even, you know, Edward Hill and the Northern Railroad. But he, for a brief period of time, almost controls the entire transatlantic rail system in the United States, including, as you talked about before, the Union Pacific. And like a lot of railroad barons, right, he doesn't build the railroads. He buys the bonds that built the railroads after all those bonds are essentially worthless. You know, many of the railroad barons were actually financiers who picked up the pieces after the initial investors lost all their money. kind of like what happened with the telecom boom of the late 1990s, right? Mm-hmm. And the one unusual thing about him is that rather than the sort of the private equity capitalist model today where you buy a distressed asset and then you try to squeeze out all the costs to make a little bit of profit, he bought these distressed assets and said, I'm going to spend a huge amount of money upgrading them. And by doing that, I will make them profitable because I will make them better. It's kind of the antithesis of that model of I'll buy a distressed asset and fire a lot of people and see what I can eke out. He's like, I'm going to upgrade the rail runs. I'm going to make these beautiful passenger cars. I'm going to increase the level of service. And I think that has to do with his idea of capitalism as being a productive capitalism and not an extractive capitalism, which doesn't mean he was an ambitious, tough, judgmental, ornery guy. He has a fascinating series of debates when he goes off to Alaska kind of on a whim and has this huge expedition, among whom was there was John Muir. And he and John Muir had this whole debate about the nature of capitalism. And John Muir says, look, I'm a much richer man than you are, Mr. Harriman, because your ambition for money knows no bounds and I'm content with what I have. So he's a complicated figure, to say the least.
And tell us a little bit about the Northern Securities Trust. What did he try to do and what happened in the Supreme Court?
Right. So, this involves J.P. Morgan and involves some of the main bankers of the day, including Jacob Schiff. They essentially create a trust, a holding company, where they were going to put the main transatlantic railroads, the Union Pacific, the Northern Railway, the Great Northern, and thereby basically control, including the Illinois Central, almost all of the major rail lines from the Mississippi to California. And Teddy Roosevelt has this reputation of being a trust buster, but frankly, one of the only trusts that he actually busts is the Northern Securities Trust, this railroad empire. And Teddy Roosevelt was a New Yorker. E.H. Harriman was a New Yorker. They both grew up in the city. Roosevelt from much more privilege than E.H. Harriman did. And it becomes this epic fight, and the Supreme Court breaks up the Northern Securities Trust, although not without some dissent about the question of do monopolies that don't seem to hurt consumers, should those actually be broken up simply because they're anti-competitive, which is clearly a question deeply relevant today for the tech monopolies, right? If they provide cheaper things to consumers, but they're anti-competitive, does trust law actually apply or should it? And that was one of the big questions in 1904 when the Northern Securities is broken up.
We hinted, or you hinted a little bit about, public service, and I want to go back to that because we did talk about it in the intro. And that is, moving from kind of finance to government. Can you tell us a bit about the careers of Bob Lovett, Prescott Bush, and Averill Harriman?
So this generation is kind of the late 1890s into the turn of the 20th century was when basically the third generation of the Brown brothers or the second generation of the robber barons, they all start going to the same school. This is when this WASP elite establishment starts coalescing around Harvard, Yale, Princeton, around the prep schools like Groton. And Groton, famously, which educated generations of Roosevelt and also educated generations of Browns, had the motto, to reign is to serve. And it was this really syrupy mix of you are destined to rule and destined to be elite, but that means that you have a responsibility to lead and give back to the public good. So it was an elite notion of public service. And you have this generation of Brown partners in the 1930s, but especially in the 40s into the 50s, including Averill Harriman, who's the son of E.H. Harriman, goes to Yale. They're all in Skull and Bones. It's partly where we get this whole sense of there's a secret cabal in, gilded rooms pulling the levers. And to some degree, there was a cabal, but they weren't necessarily in secret pulling levers. They were very publicly believing that they were destined to lead, and that belief then translates into a belief that the United States, after World War II, was kind of honor-bound and destined and responsible to lead the world, right? They were an elite that was supposed to lead America, and America was the elite nation that was supposed to lead the world because it was rich and powerful, and everybody else was suffering at the end of World War II. And so they construct this global order that includes the Marshall Plan, this multi-billion dollar effort to rebuild Western Europe in the belief that if Western Europe doesn't thrive, it'll either become communist or it won't be a good market for the United States. So again, selfless, selfish, self-serving, and of service. Robert Lovett becomes Secretary of Defense and Undersecretary to George Marshall as Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, and then Prescott Bush, the senator from Connecticut in the 1950s, who had been a Brown partner, who becomes the patriarch of the Bush political dynasty. And again, they are animated by this belief that they have a responsibility to serve society and that the United States has a responsibility to lead the world. You can think that that's all malarkey, and there's a lot of reasons to be critical of the kind of what the WASP establishment, the world they made. But I'm trying to tell the story of how this world, which is in many ways still our world, you know, we live with the legacy of the UN, of the World Trade Organization, of the Pentagon, of the CIA, the National Security Council. All these things are constructed by this cohort of, yes, Brown partners and their class.
Harriman in particular is a fascinating figure to me because of the sort of length and breadth of his public service. Really, really an interesting character that you highlight very nicely in the book. Before we go, talk a little bit about where the firm is today. I mean, it's still around. It's not Goldman Sachs. It's not, you know, Morgan Stanley, but it is still, as I understand it, a private partnership.
It is still a private partnership. And part of the way the book ends is I have a final chapter called When is Enough Enough? And the point of that is Brown Brothers Harriman is barely remembered today because it didn't go public in the 80s the way these other firms like Lehman Brothers and Goldman go public. And one of the results of that is that they never become too big to fail, and they never are able to develop a model of finance capitalism where you can use other people's money and other banks' leverage to go for immense gain with little risk of personal loss. When you're a private partnership, every deal you do, your own money is at stake. You know, today in the financial world, you might make $10 million personally, but you're highly unlikely to lose $10 million personally. And that's a huge differential of how risks have been kind of put on the public balance sheet. Shareholders will take the risks. The government, at worst, will bail you out from those risks, but gains are private. And Brown Brothers, part of my coda in the book is we both demonize and lionize the kind of excessive capitalism of Michael Milken or Gordon Gekko in the Wall Street, in the film Wall Street, or Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street. You know, we both think of these people as sordid, but we also celebrate them. Whereas the kind of quiet, you know, ramrod rectitude of limited risk, focusing on the destructive power of money and not just on the immense constructive power of money, focusing on loss and not just gain, that ethos that Brown Brothers inhabits is an afterthought. And I think that that's a problem because of the balance of it. You know, you want some speculation. You want some greed. You want some people to fund Elon Musk, and Brown Brothers Harriman would have slammed the door on him. But you don't want that ethos to be at the heart of your system, at the heart of the financial system. You don't want greed and reckless speculation that can unlock innovation. You don't want that to be at the heart of the system. You want people who are really mindful of the risks, mindful of the power of money to destroy and not just the ability of it to create. And so in some sense, it's not a plea. It's a reminder that there are other variants of capitalism and that we would be better served by having some of those other variants more prominent in our world and not just peripheral.
We've been speaking with author Zachary Carabell. He is speaking about his new book, Inside Money. And we've spent the last few minutes talking about the history of Brown Brothers Harriman and American wealth.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.